There was a gunshot, then a scream. As if the scream had been a signal, Mariel Soderson opened her eyes, arched her back, uttered a long, guttural sound, and began to shiver. Her feet rattled on the ground. "Doc!" Cynthia cried, running to Mariel. "Doc!" Gary came first. He stumbled in the kitchen doorway and would have knee-dropped onto his wife's stomach if Cynthia hadn't pushed him backward. The smell of cooking sherry hung around him in a sweet cloud.
"What's happened? What's wrong with my wife?"
Mariel's head whipped from side to side. It thumped against the wall. The picture of Daisy, the corgi who could count, fell down onto her chest. Mercifully, the glass in the frame didn't break. Cynthia grabbed it and tossed it aside. As she did, she saw the gauze over the stump of Marielle's arm had turned red. The stitches, some of them at least, had broken.
"Doc!"
she screamed. He came hurrying across from the door, where he had been standing and staring out, almost hypnotized by the changes taking place. There were snarling sounds from the green belt out back, more screams, more gunshots, at least two. Marielle stopped shivering. Her fingers moved as if she was trying to snap them, and then that stopped too. Her eyes stared blankly at the ceiling. A single tear trickled from the corner of the left one. Doc took her wrist and felt for a pulse. He stared at Cynthia with a kind of desperate intensity as he did.
"I guess if you want to go on working down street, you'll have to turn in that cashier's duster for a dance hall dress," he said. "The easy stop's a saloon now. The Lady Day."
"Is she dead?" Cynthia asked.
"Yeah," old Doc said, lowering Marielle's hand. "She needed a trauma unit, not an old veterinarian with shaky hands."
Someone was crying out there, shouting, "You should have stopped him, you should have stopped him." A sudden surety came to Cynthia. Steve, a guy she'd already come to like, was dead. The shooters were out there, and they'd killed him. Gary didn't seem to realize what had happened until old Doc pulled the brown corduroy cover off his couch and spread it over his wife. Then it got through to him, drunk or not. His face began to shiver. He groped under the couch cover, found Marielle's hand, brought it out, kissed it. He held it against his cheek and began to cry. When Jim Reed saw rapidly approaching shapes coming up the path toward him, his excitement vanished. Terror filled the space where it had been. "If you see strangers in the woods, come right back," his mom had said. But he couldn't even move. He was frozen. Then there was a horrible growling sound in the undergrowth, and he panicked. He did not see Colleen Trajan and Steve Ames when they burst into view. He saw killers who had left their vans to infiltrate the woods. He didn't hear Johnny's muffled yell or see Johnny struggling to free himself from Dave's clutching hands.
"Shoot Jimmy!"
Dave shrieked in a freaked-out falsetto.
"Shoot him! It's them!"
Jim fired, and the one on the left went down, clutching for the top of his head, which blew back in a red film of scalp and hair and bone. The rifle the man had been carrying tumbled to the side of the path. Blood poured through his fingers and sheeted over his face.
"Get the other one!"
Dave cried.
"Get him, Jimmy, before he gets us!"
"Don't shoot,"
the other guy said, holding out his hands. There was a rifle in one of them.
"Please, man, don't shoot me."
He was going to, though, going to shoot him dead. Jim pointed the gun, hardly aware that he was yelling at the guy, calling him names, cocksucker, fuckwad. All he wanted to do was kill him and get back to his mother, him and Dave both. Coming out here had been a terrible mistake. Johnny rammed both elbows back into Dave Reed's stomach, which was trim and hard but unprepared. Dave let out a surprise, "Ooh!" and Johnny tore out of his grasp. Before Jim could fire again, Johnny had seized his arm and twisted it savagely. The boy screamed in pain. His hand opened, and David Carver's pistol thumped to the path.
"What are you doing?"
Dave yelled.
"You'll kill us. Are you crazy?"
"Your brother just shot Colleen Trajan from down the block. Now how's that for crazy?"
"No,"
Jim whispered, turning to him, shaking his head. "No." But his eyes already knew. They were huge and filling with tears.
Why would he be out here?
Dave asked. Why didn't he warn us, for God's... The growl reasserted itself in the hot red air, quickly rising to a snarl. The man who was still on his feet, the guy from the rental truck, turned toward it, instinctively raising his hands. The rifle he held was very small, and he might be right to shield his neck with it rather than point it. Then the creature which had chased them up the path sprang out of the woods. Johnny's ability to think consciously and coherently ceased. All he could do was see. That ability, more curse than blessing, had never stopped before, nor did it now. The thing was a nightmare with a tawny brown coat, crooked green eyes, and a mouthful of jagged orange teeth. A misbegotten feline freak, it leapt, splintering the upheld rifle with its enormous claws and tearing it away from the clenched hands which had held it. Then, still snarling, it went for Steve's throat. From Audrey Wyler's journal. June 12, 1995. This morning, Herb got up with Seth, ran through the shower with him, and when they came down, Seth was sulking, and Herb had the start of a black eye. Seth made him punch himself, of course, although it's not really Seth who does the bad stuff, but the other one, the stalky little boy. The stalky little boy started in before I even had breakfast on the table.
Where's my dream floater?
We haven't found Dream Floater yet, I said, but I'm sure we will.
I want my Dream Floater!
He screamed at the top of his lungs, and Herb kind of winced. I didn't. At least when he's screaming, he's not throwing things.
I want my fucking Dream Floater!
Don't you swear like that in front of your Aunt Audrey, Herb said, and I was afraid at the look the SLB threw at him then, very afraid. But Herb's look back never wavered. He's so brave. And it was the SLB who finally looked down. I made him French toast, usually his favorite, but he wouldn't eat. Just stalked off to the den. Pretty soon I heard the VCR. Then one of his Motocops tapes started. When they were cackling away in there, I asked Herb how he was going to explain his black eye at work. He put his voice up to falsetto range and batted his eyes and said,
"I'll just tell the boys I ran into a door, honey."
Trying to make a joke of it. It didn't work. It's like the SLB, generates a kind of poison electricity when he's pissed. It builds up until you feel like running from room to room, screaming and beating your head against things. It makes you sweat stinky sweat, like when you have a high fever and your muscles tremble and your mouth gets dry. I'll write something in here I've never told Herb. Sometimes when it gets like that, I go into the bathroom, lock the door, and masturbate like mad. It's the only thing that seems to take a little of the pressure off. The orgasms are so hard, they're frightening. I've felt all this before when the stalky little boy inside Seth is pissed about something, but it's never gone on so long or revved up so high. By mid-afternoon, it was like the whole house was just waiting for a match to set it off. I was in the kitchen, walking aimlessly around, my head aching so badly I could feel my eyeballs throbbing, and I kept wanting to grin. I don't know why. There's nothing funny about any of it. But the more my head ached, and the more my eyes throbbed, and the more I felt the atmosphere of the house pressing in on me, the more I wanted to grin. Christ! I went to the sink and looked out the window into the backyard. Seth was sitting in the sandbox, playing with his other power wagons. If anyone but me had seen how he was playing, he would have been in some sort of special installation by nightfall, some place where the government studies exceptional children. The PWs have pop-out wings, but they don't really fly. Except sometimes Seth's do. He was sitting in the sand with his hands in his lap, and around his head they went. Tracker arrow, and Rudy Toot, and the meat wagon, and the rest. dipping and diving under each other, swooping and doing rolls, coming in for touch-and-goes on a landing strip Seth has made for them. I know I must sound like a raving madwoman, but I swear, in the name of God, it's true. Sometimes he dive-bombs the neighbor's dog with them. Herb has seen this, too. Any other little kid seeing the power wagons doing tricks like that would be clapping and cheering. But the stalky little boy just sits there in the sand, with his lip shoved out, and glares. Seth watching the wagons and me watching him, feeling whatever is inside him coming out in waves, filling the air with a hum that's mostly in a person's head, I felt ready to come out of my skin, ready to flip out right there in front of the sink. And then, all at once, the daydream came, the most wonderful thing. It's so beautiful there at Mohonk, so peaceful. I wish I could tell Herb about my place, maybe even take him there. But I think the SLB can find things out from Herb that he can't from me. And Herb looks so tired, so thin. It's unfair to both of us that this should be happening, but it's horribly unfair to Herbie. June 13th, 1995. Dweem Fwota is back. I don't know whether to feel scared or relieved. Thank God Seth was napping when the doorbell rang, and thank God Herb's at work, because I know the SLB eavesdrops on Herb's mind sometimes. Around 3 o'clock, while I was vacuuming, there was a knock on the kitchen door. I opened it, and there stood Mr. Hobart from down the street, and his son, a pudgy red-haired boy with thick glasses and pasty skin. The kid had a dream floater van in his arms. There was no question it was Seth's. I didn't have to see the broken taillight and the scratch up the driver's side to know that. It's hot today, mid-80s, but William Hobart was dressed like a church deacon in a black suit and shoes. His kid was wearing the junior version of the same get-up and sniveling. He had a pretty good bruise on one cheek, too. I'd bet my bank account his old man put it there. Hobart had the whole thing scripted. "My son has something to say to you, Mrs. Weiler," he said, and he looked down at the boy as if to say, "You're on, don't fuck it up." Sniveling harder, Hugh said he'd given in to the tempting voice of Satan. I guess that's the TVS, just like the stalky little boy is the SLB, and stolen Seth's toy. He talked real fast, crying harder and harder as he went along. He finished by saying, "You can go to the police, and I will make a full confession. You can spank me, or my dad will spank me. I have asked my dad for forgiveness, and I have asked the Lord Jesus for forgiveness, and now I am asking you for forgiveness." I got my act together enough to take the wagon from him and told him that no spankings would be required. "The boy also has to apologize to your son," Mr. Hobart said. "If you'll just lead us to him." I'll be damned if the self-righteous SOB didn't start trying to push his way right in. The last thing I wanted was that fat little thief standing in front of the stalky little boy. I wanted them out of my house and quick, before either their voices or their emotional vibes could wake him up. "Seth's not my son, he's my nephew," I said, "and he's taking a nap right now." "Very good," Hobart said, giving a stiff little nod. "We will come back later. Is tonight convenient? If not, I can bring Hugh back tomorrow afternoon. I can ill afford to take off a second afternoon, but God's business must always take precedence over man's." I herded them out the door and kept them going. The kid, meanwhile, is asking, "Do you forgive me?" over and over again, like a broken record. By the time I got them down to the sidewalk, I realized I was furious with both of them. Not just because of the hell we've been through, but because they both acted like I was somehow responsible for the thieving little fart's immortal soul. Plus, I kept remembering the way his eyes were going everywhere, seeing what we had in our house that he didn't have in his. I'm pretty sure that a lot of Seth's strange powers have a very short range. So when I got them down to the street, I felt relatively safe enough to ask how Hugh Hobart had come to lift Seth's power wagon in the first place. Pear and Feast exchanged a glance at that, a funny, uneasy glance, and I realized neither of them much minded the idea of a spanking or even a visit from the cops, but they didn't like the idea of talking about the actual theft itself.
No wonder the fundamentalists hate the Catholics so much. The idea of going to confession must make their balls shrivel. Most of it I could have figured out myself. The Hobarts belong to the Zion's Covenant Baptist Church, and one of the things they do is spread the gospel. This means leaving tracts, like the one Herb found, the one about a million years in hell and not one drink of water. William and Hugh do this together. A father and son type of thing, I guess. A holy substitute for Little League or touch football. They stick mostly to houses that look temporarily empty, or they put their little love notes under the windshields of cars on the street. They must have hit our place right after we left for Millie's. Hugh ran up the driveway and stuck the tract under the milk box, and of course he saw a dream floater wherever Seth put it down. Later, after his father had declared him off duty for the rest of the day, but before we got back from the mall, Hugh wandered back up the street and gave in to the ever-popular TVS. His mother found the PW yesterday, Monday, while Hugh was at school and she was cleaning in his room. Last night they had a family conference about it, then called their minister for his advice, had a little over-the-phone prayer, and now here they were. Once the story was out, the kid started in on, "Do you forgive me?" again. The second time through, I said, "Quit saying that." I looked at him. I was trying to look past the hate and shame and self-righteousness to see if there was a real boy left inside. "Hugh," I said, "you know that people only have to ask forgiveness if they do something wrong, don't you?" He nodded cautiously. "So you know that stealing Seth's toy was wrong?" He nodded again, more reluctantly than ever. He was practically hiding behind his father's leg. "Mrs. Weiler, I hardly think it's necessary to browbeat the boy," his old man said. "Hugh," I continued, "I want you to tell me that what you did was wrong, and it was bad, and you're sorry. Then we'll be done." Hugh glared at me, and if looks could kill, I wouldn't be writing this now.
"Dad, do I have to?"
"Go on, and tell her what she wants to hear," Hobart said. "Bitter medicine is best swallowed in a single gulp." Then he patted the kid on the shoulder, as if to say, "Yes, she's being a real bitch, but we have to put up with it." "It was wrong, it was bad, I'm sorry," the kid said, glaring at me the whole time. No more tears or sniveling. I looked up and saw the same stare coming from the father. People are amazing. They came up the street, scared but sort of exalted at the idea of getting crucified, just like their boss did. Instead, I made the kid admit what he was, and it hurt, and they both hate me for it. The important things, though, are these. 1, DF is back, and 2, the Hobarts won't talk about it. Sometimes shame is the only gag that works on people. I must think up a yarn to tell Seth, then tell the same one to Herb. The truth just isn't safe. Feet upstairs, going down to the bathroom. He's up. Please God, I hope I'm right about him not being able to see into my thoughts. Later. Big sigh of relief. Seth getting up when he did, before I had much of a chance to think what I was going to tell him, turned out to be a blessing in disguise. When he came downstairs, still with his eyes mostly puffed shut, I just held DF out to him. What happened to his face, the way it opened up in surprise and delight, was almost worth the whole damned horror show. I saw both of them in that glad look, Seth and the SLB. The SLB just glad to have his power wagon back. Seth, I think, was glad because he knows the SLB will let up on us now. For a little while, anyway. I keep thinking about the trip Bill and his family took across the country, just before he and June and the two older kids were killed. I think about how our father talked to us when we were teenagers and going for our driver's licenses. He told us there were 3 things we should never do: drive with our tire pressure low, drive drunk, or pick up hitchhikers. Could it be that Bill picked up a hitchhiker in the desert without even knowing it? That it's still riding around inside of Seth? Anyhow, with no time to lie fancy, I lied plain. "I found it in the cellar," I said, "way back under the stairs."
Seth accepted it with no questions. All night he sat in the den in his favorite chair, holding Dream Floater on his lap, watching TV. Herb brought home a movie from the video clip. Just some old black and white thing from the bargain bin, but Seth really likes it. It's a western, of course, from the late 50s. He's watched it twice already. Rory Calhoun's in it. It's called The Regulators. June 19th, 1995. I think we're in trouble. William Hobart over this morning, in a rage. Herb had left for work about 20 minutes before he showed up, thank God, and Seth was out back in the yard. He led me down the front walk and pointed down at his house. His car was standing on 4 flat tires, and all the windows had been broken, including the windshield and the big one in back. "Oh, my God, I'm so sorry," I said. I was, too, although maybe not for the reasons he thought. Well, I suppose I thought, the toy Hugh took, if you were still angry. "I've put the whole thing behind me, Mr. Hobart," I said. "Must have been vandals," he said. "Drunkards. Surely no one on the street would do such a thing." I hope it was vandals. How could it have been Seth? Or the stalky little boy, if you prefer. If I'm right about his powers having a short range. Unless his abilities are growing. His range widening. I don't dare tell Herb. June 24th, 1995. When I came downstairs this morning to start breakfast, there was a police car parked in front of the Hobart house, where there was broken glass everywhere, in the driveway and on the lawn, twinkling in the sun. William and his wife, Irene, were in their PJs talking to the cops. The little thief was standing on the stoop behind them, sucking his thumb. Every window in the house was out, it looked like, upstairs as well as down. Cammie Reed said it happened around 5:45. She was just waking up and heard it. Not as loud as you would have expected all that glass, but loud enough so you could tell what it was, she said. Weird, huh? Very, I said. My voice sounded normal enough, but I didn't dare say any more in case it started to get shaky. First his car, now this, she said. Someone's got it in for Will Hobart. June 26, 1995. Waited until Herb was at work. I didn't want him to go. He looked so pale and ill. But he said he had a big presentation this afternoon, then went out back to talk to Seth. He was sitting in the sandbox, playing quietly with his MotoCops guys, the HQ Crisis Center, and what Herb jokingly calls the Ponderosa. This is a ranch and corral setup that Herb bought for $2 at a yard sale on his way home from work one day in March or April. It's not really the Ponderosa Ranch from Bonanza, of course, but the main house, with its log sides, does look a little like it. There's also a bunkhouse. Part of the roof broken in, but it's otherwise in good shape, and plastic horses, a couple with only 3 legs, for the corral. It's been one of Seth's favorite toys. What's funny, and a little weird, is how quickly and effortlessly he incorporated the ranch into his MotoCops play fantasies. Not that I was thinking about any of this morning. I was scared, heart pounding. But when he looked up at me, I felt a little better. It was Seth, not the other one. Every time I see Seth's pale, sweet little face, I love him more. I want to protect him more, and I hate the other one more. I asked him what was happening to the Hobarts, and he didn't answer, just sat looking at me. I asked him what had to happen before he would stop. I didn't think he was going to answer that either. Then he said, very clearly for Seth, "They should move. They should move soon. I can't hold it back much longer." "Hold what back?" I asked him, but he wouldn't say anything else, just went away to wherever it is he goes. After my brother and his family were killed, the witnesses talked about a red van with a radar dish on the roof. Tracker arrow is red, and it has a dish on the roof. And the dream floater Herb and I saw in the backyard, it wasn't real, of course, but it was full-sized, and Seth was asleep when we saw it. maybe not operating at full power. Suppose the SLB gets tired of just breaking windows. Suppose he sends Tracker Arrow, or Dream Floater, or Justice Wagon, or Freedom, to do a little drive-by at the Hobarts. June 27th, 1995. Spent most of the day at Mohonk with Jan Goodlin. I know I shouldn't, but it's hard to resist. At the very end, I saw the little phone was gone, which means it's time to go back, and Jan said to me, "You know where he's getting the energy to work on the Hobarts, don't you, Aud?" "Sure I do. From Herb. Like a vampire steals blood. And I think that Herb knows." June 28, 1995. Late this morning, I heard an ambulance pull up across the street. I looked out into the backyard and saw Seth was gone. Power wagons lined up in the sandbox, slant parked, the way he always puts them when he's done for a while. The Ponderosa all neat, with the plastic horses in their corral. The HQ crisis center down near the swing. But no Seth. In front, people were standing out on their sidewalks, looking at the Hobart place. Dave Reed pointed out Seth, who was standing by the bike rack by the store, looking across the street like the rest of us. He must have gone for a candy bar. "Yes," I reply, knowing that A, Seth has no money, B, Seth can hardly talk to Herb and me, let alone to store clerks he doesn't know, C, Seth never leaves the backyard. Seth doesn't, but sometimes the stalky little boy does, it seems. To get into operating range, I think. About 5 minutes later, the EMTs helped Irene Hobart out the door. Hugh, the son, was holding her hand and crying. I hated that kid, but now I only pity him and fear for him. There was blood all down the front of her dress. She was holding a compress on her nose, and one of the EMTs was pressing the top of her neck in the back. They got her into the ambulance. Hugh got in right behind her and drove away. She was back less than 2 hours later. Kim Geller dropped by for coffee and told me she went to see if there was anything she could do for Irene. She said Irene has bad hypertension, had nosebleeds before, but never as bad as this. She told Kim it went all at once, blood just spraying out of her nostrils. I got Seth inside and started shaking him, told him he had to stop. He only looked at me, his mouth trembling, his eyes welling with tears. I was the one who stopped, ashamed of myself. I was shaking the wrong one. I could see the other one, though, hiding behind Seth's eyes and laughing at me. I think the most terrible thing of all is how the SLB knows to leave Hugh Hobart alone, to let him just watch. June 29, 1995. Woke up this morning around 3 a.m., and the other half of the bed was empty. I went out to the garage and found Herb sitting at his workbench, wearing nothing but the jockeys he sleeps in, and crying. He looks horrible. I took him in my arms, and he wept like a baby. Kept saying he was tired, so tired, all the time. I said something about taking him to see Dr. Evers first thing in the morning. He just laughed. Said I knew what was wrong with him. I do, of course. July 1, 1995. Another ambulance at the Hobart house late this afternoon. As soon as I saw it, I raced upstairs to check on Seth, who was supposedly napping. Window open, second floor window, and no Seth. When I went outside, I saw him across the street, holding old Tom Billingsley's hand. I ran across and grabbed him.
"No fear, he's all right, Aud," Tom said. "Just went a-wandering a little, didn't you, Sethy boy?"
"Don't you ever cross the street on your own," I told him. "Don't you ever!" Shook him in spite of myself. Stupid. Might as well shake a lump of wax. This time, when the EMTs came out, they were using their stretcher. William Hobart was on it. He fell downstairs, broke his leg and hip. Kim told me later that he drinks, church deacon at Zion's Covenant or not, but I don't think that's why he fell downstairs.
July 3rd, 1995. There's no stalky little boy. Never was. There's a thing inside of Seth. Not an id, not another manifestation of his personality, not a hitchhiker, but something like a tapeworm. It can think and talk. It talked to me today. It calls itself Tuck. July 6, 1995. Someone shot the Hobart's pet Angora cat last night. Apparently nothing left but blood and fur. Kim says Irene H. is hysterical, thinks everyone on the street is out to get them, because they know the Hobarts are going to heaven and the rest of us are going to hell. So they're making this hell on earth for us, is what she told Kim. What in God's name should I do? It hasn't hurt anyone yet, but... July 8th, 1995. Oh, God, thank you. A Mayflower van turned onto the street at just past 9 this morning and stopped in front of the Hobarts. They are moving out. July 16th, 1995.
Oh, you fucking little bastard, you shit. Oh, how could you? Oh, you bastard, if I could get at you. If you let Seth go and I could get at you. Oh, God, God, God. My fault. Yes. How much my fault is the question. Dear Jesus, how can I live without him? How go on with this? I didn't know there could be this much pain in the whole wide world. And how much my fault? How much? You bastard, Tack, you bastard. I'm done writing in this book. What good did I ever think it could do anyway? Oh, Herb, I'm so sorry. I love you. I'm so sorry.
October 19th, 1995. Got an answer to my letter today, ages after I'd given up expecting one, from a mining engineer named Alan Symes. He works at a place called the China Pit in Desperation, Nevada. Says he saw Bill and his family. He just showed them the mine, and they went on. Nothing happened. He's lying. I'll probably never know why or what happened out there. But I know that much. God help me. It all happened fast, but Johnny's half-wonderful, half-terrible ability to see in sequence kept up. And Trajan was crawling toward one of the primitive cacti, his head hanging so low it left a swath of blood on the ground growth. His skull gleamed between hanging flaps of hair like a bleary pearl. In the middle of the path, a bizarre waltz was going on. The creature from the ravine, a sinister Picasso mountain lion with jutting orange teeth, was up on its hind legs, paws on Steve Ames's shoulders. If Steve had dropped his arms when the cat clawed the puny 22 away from him, he would have been dead already. He had crossed them over his chest instead, however, and now his elbows and forearms were against the cat's chest.
"Shoot it!"
he screamed.
"For Christ's sake, shoot it!"
Neither twin made a move for the dropped pistol. They wore identical expressions of anguish. The mountain lion uttered a womanish shrieking cry and darted its triangular head forward. Steve snapped his own head back and tried to throw the creature off. The two of them tangoed drunkenly, and Johnny could see blood blossoms spreading on Steve's shoulders where the claws were dug in. They did another half turn, and Steve's feet tangled. He tottered on the edge of balance, still holding off the lunging mountain lion with his crossed arms. Coyotes wailed, still out of sight, but closer now. The air was tangy with smoke from the burning house.
"Shoot this fucking thing!"
Steve yelled. He had managed to catch his balance, but before long would be all out of backing up room. He was at the edge of the path. One step into the thorny underbrush, two at most, and he would go over. Then the nightmare would rip his throat out.
"Shoot it, please! It's tearing me apart!"
Johnny, never so terrified in his life, scooped up Entragian's rifle,
flicked the safety off with his thumb, and he socked the .30-06's muzzle against the side of the mountain lion's bulging head.
Push!
He bellowed, and Steve pushed. The cat's head rocked up and away from his throat. Its bristle of teeth shone like poison coral. Johnny pulled the trigger. There was a satisfying whip-crack sound, a lick of fire from the barrel, and then Johnny could smell frying hair. The mountain lion fell sideways, its head mostly gone, the fur on the back of its neck smoldering. What was inside its lifted skull was not blood, bone, and tissue, but fibrous pink stuff that reminded Johnny of the blown-in insulation he'd gotten for his house.
Woo, woo, woo!
Johnny looked around nervously. He could still see nothing, but the sons of bitches sounded closer than ever. Dave Reed kept thinking that pretty soon he would wake up. Never mind that he could smell the cop's blood and sweat as he knelt beside him. Never mind the tortured sound of the cop's breathing, the cop's one dying eye, or the sight of his gray and wrinkled brain pushing through a shattered window in his skull. It had to be a dream. Surely his brother could not have shot the guy from across the street. A crooked cop, yes, but also the guy who had once told Carrie Ripton to try throwing a baseball with his fingers across the seams instead of lying along them, and who had then demonstrated by throwing a brain-busting rainbow change. Smells like he shit his pants, Dave thought, and suddenly felt like vomiting. He controlled it. He didn't want to vomit again, even in a dream. The cop reached up and hooked his fingers into Dave's shirt.
Hurt,
he whispered hoarsely.
Hurt.
Don't, Dave swallowed, cleared his throat. Try to talk. Collie and Trajan's remaining eye stared at the boy with ferocious concentration.
Never, he whispered. Never.
Sir, Mr. Entragian, you'd better just woo, 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 woo!
Close enough this time to make Dave Reed's skin feel as if it were freezing. The cop's eye held him like a bug on a pin, and one of his blood-streaked hands had knotted a handful of Dave's shirt into a loose fist.
Never took drugs, sold them, any of it, Collie whispered. Never took a dime. Framed. I.A. shoe flies on the take, I found out. I found out. You understand what I am saying?
He held up the hand that wasn't knotted in Dave's shirt, opened it, and appeared to examine it.
Hands clean.
Yeah, okay, Dave said. But you better not try to talk. You got, well, a little crease and...
Jim, no!
Marinville screamed from behind him.
Don't!
Dave suddenly discovered he could pull away from the dying man quite easily. Jim Reed stood with the pistol pressed against the side of his head just long enough for Steve to hope that he'd had a change of heart at the penultimate moment, that last little vestibule of maybe not, before the endless hallway of too late. And then Jim pulled the trigger. His head blew apart, so much vapor in the strange sunset air. Red goo splattered across one of the insane cacti like spit. He staggered forward a step on buckling knees, the gun tumbling from his hand, then went down. Steve turned his thunderstruck face to Johnny's, thinking, I didn't see what I just saw. No, man, no. Except he had. The kid, overcome with remorse and horror at what he had done to the guy from down the street, had just committed impulse suicide in front of him.
You should have stopped him, Dave Reed screamed, hurling himself at Johnny. You should have stopped him. Why didn't you stop him?
Steve tried to grab the kid on his way by, but the pain in his shoulders was excruciating. He could only watch helplessly as Dave Reed grabbed Johnny and bore him to the ground. They rolled over twice, from one side of the path to the other. Johnny wound up on top, at least for a moment.
David, listen to me.
No, no, you should have stopped him. You should have stopped him.
The kid slapped Johnny, first with his right hand, then his left.
He was sobbing, tears streaming down his pale cheeks. Steve tried again to help and succeeded only in distracting Johnny, who'd been trying to pin the boy's arms with his knees. Dave rocked up hard on one hip, throwing Johnny off the path to the left. Johnny put a hand out to break his fall and got a palm full of cactus spines instead. He roared in pain and surprise. Steve got hold of Dave Reed's shoulder with his right hand, but the boy shook him off easily, not even looking around, and then sprang onto Johnny Marinville's broad back, got his hands around his throat, and began to choke him. And, all around them in the swiftly darkening day, the coyotes howled. Perfect, round howls. The kind Steve had never heard, even though he'd grown up in Texas. Howls like these you only heard in the movies. Both men had wanted to come with her, but Cynthia wouldn't have it. One was old, the other drunk. The gate at the bottom of the lawn was still open. A moment after going through it, she was fighting her way through the underbrush. She saw several cacti, but they didn't register. She could hear a struggle up ahead, harsh, strained breathing, a cry of pain, the thud of a landed blow, and coyotes. They sounded as if they were everywhere. As she reached the path, a trim little blonde in jeans blew past her. Cammy Reed, the twins' mother. Following her and panting heavily was Brad Josephson. Rivulets of sweat were running down his cheeks. The late light made him look as if he were crying tears of blood. Sun's going down, Cynthia thought as she turned onto the path and ran after the others. If we don't get out of here soon, we're apt to get lost. And wouldn't that be fun? There was a shriek from just ahead of her. Horror and grief mingled. The Reed woman. Cynthia heard Brad say, "Oh, no. Oh, fuck." Just as she reached him. For a moment, Josephson's broad back obscured what was going on. And then he bent beside Cammy, and Cynthia saw two bodies sprawled in the thickening shadows. But she could see Steve standing to one side of the melee, and the sight of him made her feel glad. At his feet was the carcass of a horribly misshapen animal, with half its head blown away. Cammy Reed was on her knees beside one of the corpses, not touching it, but holding her shaking hands out over it, palms up, wailing. Cynthia saw the Eddie Bauer shorts and understood it was one of her sons. Brad worked at getting the other twin off Johnny Marinville. The big black man had gotten his arms under the teenager's arms and locked his hands together behind Dave's neck, giving him full Nelson leverage. Still, the Reed boy did not come easily.
"Let me go," he bawled. "Let me go, you son of a bitch. He killed my brother. He killed Jimmy."
Mrs. Reed's keening stopped. She looked up. The still, questioning expression on her white face frightened Cynthia. "What?" she said, so low that she might have been speaking to herself. "What did you say?"
"He killed Jimmy," Dave Reed bawled.
His head was bent strenuously forward under the pressure Brad was exerting on his neck, but he still pointed unerringly at Johnny, who was getting to his feet. Blood trickled from one of the writer's nostrils in a thin ribbon.
"No,"
Johnny said heavily. The woman wasn't listening to him. Cynthia saw that clearly in her white and frozen face, but Marinville didn't.
"I understand how you feel, David, but..."
The woman looked down. Cynthia looked down with her. They both saw the .45 on the path and both went for it. Cynthia got her hand on it first, but then fingers cold and strong closed over it and plucked the pistol away.
"It was all a terrible accident," Johnny was mumbling.
He seemed to be speaking mostly to Dave. He looked on the verge of fainting. "That's how you have to think of it."
"Look out!" Steve cried then. "Jesus Christ, lady, no, don't!"
She lifted the .45, centering it on Johnny Marinville's forehead. There was no question in Cynthia's mind that she meant to kill him, would have killed him, if not for who came between Cammy and her intended target just before she could squeeze the trigger.